Good afternoon, Nikolai Beilharts with you for the Country Hour. Today, we've been talking a lot about how big this season's grain harvest is. And while that's great news, the prices that growers are looking at, well, they're not so great. In fact, they're at lows that haven't been seen for years. So some growers are saying they'll harvest double, triple, maybe even more than they did last year, but they won't actually make any more money than last year. So we'll find out what, if anything, growers can do about that. Also on the program, a Victorian abattoir has agreed to a court-enforced undertaking that includes funding a $100,000 Q fever awareness campaign after four of its workers contracted the disease. So do people know enough about the risks of getting Q fever? Or is it just the case that vaccinations are too expensive? More details after Rural News.
G'day, I'm Brett Worthington. I will warn you in advance, things are going to get very quirky very shortly. But in breaking news this lunchtime, the Treasurer Scott Morrison has approved the sale of S. Kidman & Co. to mining magnate Gina Rinehart and her Chinese joint partner. Under the deal, Anna Creek Station in South Australia will be carved out and sold separately to the Williams family. Gina Rinehart had pledged to go it alone if the Treasurer blocked her plan to partner with the Chinese real estate firm Shanghai Cred. To other news, the Australian Food and Grocery Council is worried the new supermarket code of conduct will be undone by the federal court dismissing charges against Woolworths. The court ruled Woolworths' conduct was not unconscionable when it demanded $18 million from suppliers in 2014. Woolworths buyers phoned and emailed their suppliers to seek payments to help fill a $53 million shortfall. The Food and Grocery Council's Gary Dawson says it sends a terrible message that this behaviour is still acceptable.
It would be very concerning if this was seen as a green light for practices that really are tantamount to extortion, and some of the bad practices of the past, including these sort of retrospective demands for payments under threat of retribution. So that would be very concerning to us.
WorkSafe Victoria will withhold charges against an abattoir where four workers contracted Q fever due to the company's commitment to fund a $100,000 awareness campaign about the disease. The Midfield Group in southwest Victoria has agreed to a court-enforced undertaking to fully fund a statewide campaign, which will be rolled out by the lobby group, the Victorian Farmers Federation. VFF Livestock Chairman Leonard Valance says he was shocked to hear that the abattoir had not ensured workers were vaccinated.
It is surprising that that came about. Like all employers, they have a responsibility to their employees to ensure a safe workplace, and unfortunately people are quite vulnerable in an abattoir environment where disease is aerosoled in the air and so forth, and disease is easily contracted.
Reduced supply and growing demand is likely to drive up lamb prices next year. Meat and Livestock Australia's latest projections expect lamb slaughter rates to fall 2% on this year. On the export front, lamb shipments are anticipated to ease 4% year on year. While grain growers say they're heading for a huge harvest, things seem to be falling flat in another area, the all-important price. Wheat is sitting near five-year lows due to a global oversupply. Mercado analyst Andrew Whitelaws says that while it's great to have a big crop, it doesn't necessarily prove to be a good thing if prices don't match up.
I think there should be a real push away from people talking about production, and it should really be a case of people looking at the gross margins as opposed to just straight yield. At the end of the day, you can produce a hell of a big crop and not make any money from it. And in some cases, you might produce a smaller crop and gain more from it.
Okay, let's get a little quirky. And fake fur overcoats are a new fashion craze in China, and it could help further increases in Australian wool prices. According to wool consultant Andrew Dennis, up to 10 million kilos of wool have gone into manufacturing the three-quarter length coats. He says as the Chinese winter sets in, demand for the colourful coats has increased considerably.
It looks like a sheepskin, except it doesn't actually have the skin on the reverse side of it. It's got a knitted fabric where the wool is knitted into this fabric, and it becomes a sheepskin-like material.
There are some fantastic photos of those coats on our website right now. Okay, let's get a little festive. And for many, it wouldn't be Christmas without fresh Aussie prawns on the table. The good news for those who like to indulge is there should be no shortage ahead of the festive season. After 2 weeks at sea, the Spencer Gulf prawn fishing fleet returned from their pre-Christmas run 4 days early. It's a catch that has far exceeded the expectations of coordinator Greg Palmer.
Yeah, we've completed our run before Christmas. Normally it takes around, on average, we take about 17, 18 nights per year to catch the allocated tonnage. And this year we did it in 14 nights, so that's great for the economics and the environment.
And fast food has been taken to the next level in the country with Australia's first lamb vending machine installed at a convenience store in southern New South Wales. It takes around 3 minutes for the machine to heat and dispense a tray of lamb meatballs. The idea behind it is that the industry wanted to find a way to value add secondary cuts like lamb trim. The store owner and sheep farmer Peter Nolan hopes 24/7 lamb meals will take off.
Can't see why we can't go nationwide with this type of meal and other meals within these machines. We may be able to export that technology, and there's, I don't think, anywhere in the world where there's a concept of paddock to vending machines. So that's pretty exciting. You wouldn't know where that would go in the end.
There's a great video of it on our homepage. And just think, who needs to cook a Christmas lunch when they can line up for a hot meal from a vending machine? It's a thought that I'll leave you with.
Thanks very much, Brett Worthington. Yes, I can imagine that perhaps on Christmas Day, 11:30 in the morning, you think, oh dear, forgotten the lamb. There we go, the lamb vending machine. Who would have guessed that would have been your saviour? Nikolai Beilharts with you for the Country Hour. Let's head straight to some breaking news this lunchtime. And as we've heard in National Rural News, the Federal Treasurer, Scott Morrison, has approved the sale of S. Kidman & Co. to Gina Rinehart and the Chinese-owned group Shanghai Cred. Now, as I say, this has just really come through in the last few moments. Our Parliament House reporter, Anna Vito, has been following it and joins us. Anna, what do we know about the sale so far?
Well, we know that it's over, pretty much, finally, after this incredibly long-running, twisting and turning saga. It appears that the battle for S. Kidman & Co. has finally been won, and it has been won, as has been clear for quite some time now, by mining magnate Gina Rinehart. All that was really left to establish and for the Treasurer to decide was whether he was happy for Gina Rinehart to proceed with the sale in partnership with her Chinese joint venture partner, that's Shanghai Cred, a real estate firm from China, or whether he was going to reject the Chinese component and insist that Gina Rinehart went it alone. Well, today the Treasurer has announced that he is happy for Gina Rinehart's preferred bid to go ahead, and she will buy the Kidman properties in concert with Shanghai Cred out of China. As we know, under that arrangement, the largest Kidman property, Anna Creek, that's the huge property in South Australia that is adjacent to the Woomera weapons testing range, that will be carved out of this sale, and that will be sold separately to the Williams family of Australia, Anna Creek and the Peak, which is sort of the neighbouring large properties there in South Australia. That is now approved. The only very small hurdles, I understand, between where we are right now and this being completely finished off is one more approval that needs to come from China. I spoke with Greg Campbell, the managing director of Kidman & Co. a very short time ago, though, and he says that last Chinese approval was contingent on the Australian government clearing the way. He doesn't anticipate that there will be any more problems and believes that they could actually wrap this up before Christmas.
Right, so quick turnaround. So as you mentioned, Gina Rinehart's business will own 67% of the operation all up, and Shanghai Cred will own 33%. Unless I've missed it, I haven't seen a dollar amount yet. We don't know how much it's sold for.
I believe I've just realised I forgot to double check, but I'm pretty sure we're talking about a $360 million sale was the amount that had been thrown around. You're right, though, that final dollar figure has not been confirmed today, but certainly we were looking in the order of well above $300 million for this sale.
And like you say, it sounds like there aren't too many hurdles to stop it from going ahead now.
It doesn't look like it, no. So I'd spoken to Greg Campbell, again, the managing director of Kidman, a few days ago, just to get a sense of whether they knew whether this was going to be wrapped up before Christmas or not, and they really didn't know. All of this has really been resting with the Treasurer, but the companies were really trying to get as many of their ducks in a row so that when the decision did come through, they would be able to move quite quickly, and they do expect that they will be able to move quite quickly now. I will just add, though, Greg Campbell and Kidman & Co. found out about the Treasurer's decision at the same time as the rest of us did about 20 minutes ago. So, you know, things move quickly in Canberra.
And everyone's still digesting it. Thanks so much for your time, Anna.
Thanks, Nick.
Anna Vito there reporting live from Canberra with that breaking news, as we've heard, about 20 minutes old now, that S. Kidman & Co. looks like the sale will be going ahead to the joint operation of Gina Rinehart, which is called Outback Beef. They'll take over 67% of the S. Kidman & Co. business. A minority interest of 33% will be held by Shanghai Cred, and that is with the exclusion, as Anna mentioned, of her namesake, Anna Creek Station, and its outstation, The Peak, as well. Now, of course, there will be a lot more developing on this, so if you want to keep up to speed with it, abc.net.au/rural is the best place to head for that. Well, plenty of other news happening today as well. The Australian Food and Grocery Council is worried that suppliers will be vulnerable to demands from supermarkets following the federal court dismissing a case against Woolworths. The court found Woolworths' Mind the Gap program, which asked suppliers to pay retrospective payments, was not unconscionable. Gary Dawson of the Food and Grocery Council says it sends a terrible message that this behaviour could still be acceptable.
Look, it's frustrating because there has been a lot of effort over the last couple of years to improve relationships between retailers and suppliers. And this really flies in the face of that. It would be very concerning if this was seen as a green light for practices that really are tantamount to extortion, and some of the bad practices of the past, including these sort of retrospective demands for payments under threat of retribution. So that would be very concerning to us when so much work has gone into trying to remove those practices through initiatives like the Food and Grocery Code of Conduct and a great deal of work that's been done quite constructively with the major retailers.
Would the Code of Conduct rule out the behaviour that we saw, 2 years ago?
Well, look, that's what we're working through now, working through the judgment. The Code certainly has a prohibition on retrospective claims, and we certainly saw these events as being retrospective. I mean, the facts are that Woolworths was able to recoup around $18 million in the space of a few days out of their suppliers based on the claim that the products they were selling weren't generating the profit that Woolworths had expected. So, those sort of retrospective demands for top-up payments, we believe, are certainly not on under the code, but clearly the upshot of this judgment is going to be a lot more scrutiny around whether the code is strong enough, whether the law is strong enough.
So there is potential here that the code is undermined by this ruling?
Well, the code was not legally in place when these events happened. Woolworths had verbally made commitments in support of the code, but the code itself was still working through the regulatory review process. So since then, of course, there's new management at Woolworths. They've said publicly that they will be held to a higher standard in future. We've welcomed that. We've worked with Woolworths on various initiatives to improve supplier relationships. So we would want to see that continue, and it's frustrating and quite disappointing that this judgment flies in the face of that.
That is Gary Dawson of the Food and Grocery Council speaking there with Serena Locke. While many grain growers are rejoicing about how big this year's crop is looking, the same can't be said when it comes to prices. They're the lowest that they've been in years, which has led some growers to think that they probably won't actually make any more money than last year, despite the crops being so much bigger. Andrew Whitelaw is a grain market analyst with Mercado, says he thinks there should be more focus on gross margins than big yields.
That's the main issue, is that it's all very well creating fantastic yields, but when prices don't marry up particularly well with those yields, it's going to impact upon people's gross margins. And in some cases, people will be not making much more than they would have done in a poor year with good prices.
So do you think that gross margins should really be the focus instead of yields, in a sense?
I think there should be a real push away from people talking about production. And it should really be a case of people looking at the gross margins as opposed to just straight yield. At the end of the day, you can produce a hell of a big crop and not make any money from it. And in some cases, you might produce a smaller crop and gain more from it.
Can you put things in a bit of context for us about how low prices are at the moment?
So we've seen prices drop off again since the ABARES released their crop forecast. So we're sitting on a bumper crop. And basically, we've seen the premium that we generally receive a premium over Chicago futures. We start to see that erode, and that's as a result of the trade realizing that, well, there is a big crop now. The grower hasn't sold much of it this year, and so it's a supply and demand. So the trade's not going to pay up for as big a crop.
Is wheat the crop that is facing the biggest challenges price-wise?
No, I think it's really wheat and barley, both facing some fairly heady winds against them. It's not looking too flash right at them at the moment. And in reality, it's really a case of, over the past four seasons, globally, we've seen some pretty big crops where production has exceeded consumption, which has resulted in us having globally record stocks. My concern is that we are sitting on these big global stocks. Prices aren't going to be going anywhere north for at least the next couple of months, I wouldn't think, until we start to see what's happened with the 2017-18 crop.
You mentioned silos and people holding stock on farm. Certainly, anecdotally, we've heard that a lot of people are going to be doing that as much as they can. Is that likely to see them get higher returns in the long term?
I guess when we look at it, the prices just now are at very low levels. So if it was going to work, this is the year that it's going to work. We're at low levels just now. We've been at low levels for quite some time. When we come into next year, I guess some people are of the view that the only way is up, but we could actually sit here at these type of levels, a bit like a lull for the next 6 to 9 months. At that point, you're paying carry all the way through for this crop. Hold on to grain is not the worst idea in the world, but there are other alternatives as well out there to give you that exposure to the further out period, so that it's sort of the second half of 2017. For instance, you could use a pool. There's plenty of pool providers out there. You'd have to look at what each of their strategies were and see if it fitted in with your requirements, or you could use derivatives. You can use, I guess, a cash and call option where you sell your grain at harvest, considering that we still do have positive basis levels, especially in the likes of Western Australia. Take out a call option, which will give you that exposure to the to any upside in the market.
And so just finally, if you were to do a little bit of crystal ball gazing, do you see any price rises on the way, or are they likely to like you say, be in a lull for a while longer?
Well, I guess we did see overnight India has removed their import tariff. So previously they had a 10% import duty. They've removed that because they want to fill up their supplies after two poor production years. That's a bit of a positive. But other than that, most of the crop around the world is in the silos for 2016. So the world has a good view of where the stocks are currently sitting. I guess I personally don't really see a huge upside until February, March, and that upside will come if there appears to be an issue in the likes of Russia, Ukraine, or United States.
You can never have it all, can you? That's Andrew Whitelaws. He's a grain market analyst with Mercado. If you're a grain grower, I'm wondering if this is top of mind at the moment, whether in a sense harvest is going to be big and probably good, but whether or not you'll actually be able to capitalise on it, particularly if you are thinking, well, maybe it's time to hold on to as much as we can, keep it on the farm. You can send us a text. 0467 842 722 is the text number. 0467 842 722. Well, it's not just grains that's looking at a big year. The almond industry too is forecasting its 2017 harvest to be the biggest crop on record. But despite the growth in nut production, the industry's peak body says it isn't too concerned about a drop in prices or demand. CEO of the Almond Board of Australia, Ross Skinner, says growers should still expect a return of about $8 a kilo. Emma Brown began by asking just how much bigger next year's harvest will be than the previous record of 82,000 tonnes set in 2015.
It's going to be a record crop for us in 2017, an increase from last year's crop of approximately 5,000 tonnes. and 3,000 tonnes more than the 2015 crop. So 85,000 tonnes will be the new record crop if we manage to get it through to harvest.
When it comes to domestic consumption, we saw in the 2015-2016 year that Australians are consuming about 22,000 tonnes of almonds, or a bit more than that, but still just about 2,000 of them are imported. Are we likely to reduce the amount of nuts that we're importing and begin to rely almost completely on our domestic supply?
Well, the tonnage of imports that we get into Australia are really to fill gaps within the quality range, and they're really not an issue with taking demand away from Australian product. So just to give you some example, the Australian industry supplies over 20,000 tonnes to the domestic market, and exports are running at something like 1,400 tonnes.
So when it comes to our actual supply, as you've said, record crop predicted for next year, we're still seeing, you know, hundreds of hectares of almonds being planted right around the country. Should this become a norm that we expect basically every year to be a record year until we reach the peak of our production as these new trees come online?
Yes, well, with the expansion of the industry, as those trees mature, we'll get a natural increase in production, something that we've seen over the last decade anyway, until we had a slight plateauing in production the last few years.
So how much could our production increase by?
Well, we're expecting, based on the amount of planting that's going in and the average yields that are achieved from trees, that by 2025 there'll be something like 130,000 tonnes produced. So a significant increase over what we're currently producing.
So if Australia's only consuming, maybe 25,000 tonnes of that, where are the rest of those nuts going to go?
Well, they're already, for every tonne that we consume in Australia, we're exporting 3 tonnes, and we'd expect that the majority of that new tonnage will go to export markets.
So what are the up-and-coming export markets for Australia, particularly now that the American industry seems to be returning completely to strength now that they're out of that terrible drought?
With exports, we're really in a position to continue to expand all markets. We don't believe that any of them have really reached maturity, and we're seeing growth in all our export markets. The health benefits of almonds are becoming more and more known to consumers all around the world, and that's driving an increase in demand, plus also their use in manufactured products. So around the world last year, over 9,000 new products went on supermarket shelves using almonds as an ingredient. In Australia alone, it was over 200 new products went on Australian supermarket shelves using almonds. So there's certainly a growth happening in both the snacking and manufacturing areas right around the world.
That's CEO of the Almond Board of Australia, Ross Skinner, speaking there with Emma Brown. 28 past 12 here on the Country Hour. That doesn't mean it's time to get the latest now in local news headlines with Rachel Hayter. Afternoon, Rachel.
Good afternoon, Nikolai. The Federal Treasurer, Scott Morrison, has approved the sale of pastoral giant S. Kidman & Co. to mining magnate Gina Rinehart and a Chinese consortium. Mr. Morrison says with the recommendation from the Foreign Investment Review Board, he's come to the conclusion the acquisition was not contrary to the national interest. Residents near Coolong, southwest of Mildura, are being advised that smoke from a burning pile of almond husks will remain in the air for some days. Firefighters are on the scene of the 100 by 20 metre blaze that's not yet under control. The CFA says the fire is difficult to extinguish because of the density of the husks. A senior Victorian government minister, Jacinta Allen, has indicated she's open to changing assisted dying laws, provided the legislation gets it right. State Parliament will vote on whether to legalise assisted dying later next year. The Nationals Party leader, Peter Walsh, has indicated he'll oppose the change. The head of Bendigo's Emergency Housing Agency has criticised the political debate surrounding a new funding deal for National Homelessness Services. The National Partnership Agreement that funds support services has been extended for another 12 months, despite pleas for a longer-term deal. Haven Homesafe's Ken Marchingo says the $117 million deal is pocket change for the federal government. And the Greater Shepparton Council is hoping to have the future of the city's Maud Street Mall outlined as soon as possible. The mall has been identified by council as in desperate need of revitalisation to lure in more foot traffic and boost business. The Shepparton Mayor, Dini Adem, says council staff are eager to seek community feedback and move forward with the project. For more stories, you can visit our website, abc.net.au/news.
Thanks so much, Rachel Hayter, there with local news headlines. Let's head straight off to the Bureau of Meteorology. Richard Carline is on duty, and Richard, we did see a bit of rain coming through yesterday. Was there much in it?
Hello, Nikolai. Yeah, there was through the central ranges. The showers are fed up in the southwesterly airflow across the bay into those hills to the east of Melbourne. And the highest rainfall was a standout, Polley Range near Healesville, 71 millimetres. Mount Donabuang had 50, Mount Hotham 43, Warburton 41, and the Dandenongs had around 30 to 40 millimetres. So that has concentrated that heavier rain through the east central ranges. Elsewhere in the south, most totals were between 5 and 20 millimetres. Again, particularly that central, the remaining parts of the central district and also coastal locations. But very little of the shower activity got to northern Victoria, so fairly low totals there. Now, the shower activity is still continuing today. This morning it's been concentrated again through that same area through the central ranges, but it has started to ease in the last hour or two. Elsewhere in the south, the showers have been very isolated in the southwest, mainly near the coast, and there has been some shower activity over Gippsland, both coastal and up into the hills. But totals are much, much lower today. We're down to the last few millimetres left in this southwesterly airstream. They're very cold at the moment. Just looking, I can't see any temperatures into the 20s right at this moment. The highest I can see is 19 degrees at Mildura. Most temperatures in the north between 15 and 18. In the south between 14 and 16. So very cold air mass. There was a sprinkling of snow in the Alpine area this morning. And conditions will continue cool this afternoon. The winds are easing a little. They're still fresh to strong about the coast, but they should ease from the west as a high pressure system is approaching from the Bight. And that high will be the main influence across the weekend as it drifts just to the south of the state. By Sunday night, it should be heading towards the Tasman Sea. But still, a moist south to southwesterly airstream continuing for the weekend, so we will see some shower activity mainly near the coast. So into tomorrow, isolated morning showers near the coast, otherwise fine. Still quite cool, but it will be a degree or two warmer than today. Mostly sunny over the north. Cloud in the south may break a little over inland areas through the afternoon. On Sunday, we'll see isolated early drizzle near the coast. Then it should be fine, and we should see more sunshine in the south. If there is any morning cloud, it should break up to mostly sunny conditions, and the north should be fine and sunny right through the day with light south to southeasterly winds. Temperatures picking up a little over inland areas, picking up towards the mid to high 20s, but still quite cool on the coast with temperatures in the teens. Monday, generally warm across the state. Winds go around to the north with that Tasman Sea high, and we should have a fine, mostly sunny day with light to moderate northerly winds. Still some afternoon sea breezes near the coast. Those sea breezes will be mainly along the Gippsland and central coast. But we'll see temperatures to the low to mid-30s inland. Right on the coast, temperatures closer to the mid-20s. Tuesday looks like the hot day for the week. It'll start out fine with a gusty northerly wind and temperatures reaching the mid to high 30s across most of the state, but we'll see cloud increasing and we'll see some shower activity develop from the west with some storm activity later. Most of the rainfall on Tuesday will be in the western half of the state with falls between 2 and 15 millimetres. A cooler southerly change developing in the far west towards the end of the day. And we might see fire dangers nudging severe in over western and central parts of the state. Now into Wednesday, behind the change, still some rainfall about, particularly across central and eastern areas, perhaps another 2 to 15 millimetres as showers slowly move eastwards. But by Thursday and Friday, the next high should be approaching from the west and we should be back to mainly dry conditions and also much lower temperatures. So fairly mild weekend, then a warm to hot start to the week, some rainfall around Tuesday and Wednesday, and then finding up by this time next week.
Another little peek at summer. Thanks so much, Richard.
Thanks, Nikolai.
Richard Carline at the Bureau of Meteorology. It's 25 to 1 here on the Country Out. I'm Nikolai Beilharts. Well, a Victorian abattoir has agreed to a court-enforced undertaking that includes a $100,000 Q fever awareness campaign after four of its workers contracted the disease. WorkSafe Victoria charges against the midfield group will effectively be withdrawn if the company meets these court requirements. State lobby group, the Victorian Farmers Federation, has agreed to roll out the campaign in the form of advertisements and workshops throughout 2017. Leonard Valance is VFF Livestock Chairman.
Midfield were involved in some court proceedings and we were approached by a mediator on behalf of Midfields to provide an extension service to the rural community.
Does it surprise you that there were abattoir workers that hadn't had a vaccination?
It is surprising that that came about, yeah.
What's your understanding of the requirements for abattoirs and protecting their workers in that sense?
Well, like all employers, they have a responsibility to their employees to ensure a safe workplace. And unfortunately, people are quite vulnerable in an abattoir environment where disease is aerosoled in the air and so forth, and disease is easily contracted.
And this isn't just about abattoir workers. This is about the entire livestock industry and everyone involved.
It's for the entire supply chain, people living in rural areas that come in contact with livestock.
This is an awareness campaign. Do you think that people are still unaware of the dangers of Q fever?
I think there's an enormous amount of ignorance out there in the wider community about Q fever and other zoonotic diseases that are out there relating to livestock. And we've been, as the VFF, has been campaigning with the federal government to reintroduce a vaccination program on a national basis with not much success today.
So that is still the goal of the VFF, to get the federal government to fund these vaccinations for who exactly?
For everyone in the wider community. It's a community disease, so it's just a simple public health issue. There are a number of cases a year in the state. My understanding is that there's approximately about 600 cases a year reported to the health authorities.
On a national level?
Yeah.
Do you know anyone that has contracted Q fever and, you know, can you describe what it can do to people?
I don't know anyone personally, but as I understand it, there are varying levels of disease infection that you can get. Some people just have a mild cold symptoms and other people become quite ill.
What is your key message in this campaign?
People need to be aware of the environment they work in, come along to the forums, learn about the prevention measures that they can put in place and to make themselves safe against the disease and seek vaccination from their practitioners. It is quite an expensive vaccination to pay for yourself. I think it's around the $250 roughly figure.
Do you think that's a deterrent?
Oh, I don't think that's the deterrent. I think it's just people aren't aware of it. And many years ago, there was a national program of vaccinations, and which I took part of in years ago. And it's just one of those things that's been dropped off the radar over the years.
And how far away do you think the VFF is from being successful in campaigning the federal government for this funding?
All of those things take quite a while, and it's a good opportunity for Barnaby Joyce to actually do something for rural Australians for a change.
That's Leonard Valance. He's chairman of the VFF Livestock Group, speaking there with Danny Grindley. The midfield group didn't respond to the ABC's requests for comment. Well, as we've heard, WorkSafe were responsible for bringing the case against Midfield Meats. We're joined by Adam Watson. He's the head of operations and emergency management with WorkSafe. Adam Watson, why did you opt for this educational campaign outcome rather than pushing for a conviction?
Hi, Nikolai, and thanks for having me on air today. Listen, Medfield Meats, as an alternative to prosecution in this matter, have we have an alternative pathway, which is an enforceable undertaking. So that's accepted by WorkSafe as an alternative to prosecution, and WorkSafe accepts such things if it believes it will deliver significant health and safety benefits that may outweigh the deterrent effect that flows from a conviction or fine.
So you do see that really people will get there will be a better outcome overall by doing this?
In this instance, yes, we were in a position to agree to the enforceable undertaking that was proposed by Midfield.
And I'm guessing with the word enforceable in there, there are ramifications if they don't do what they say they're going to do.
Yeah, there certainly are, Nikolai. Listen, in this instance, Midfield have agreed through the enforceable undertaking to contribute $100,000 to the VFF to raise awareness of the issue. And as Leonard mentioned earlier, there is some ignorance out there, and awareness is really a key thing. So we see that's filling the gap. But importantly, and in addition to that, they've also agreed to contribute $8,000 to the Livestock and Rural Transporters Association of Victoria for a Cue Fever awareness campaign, and then another $5,000 to creating guidance material in languages other than English for its employees and the sector in general.
Well, what is the responsibility for meat processors to their workers and staff? Do they have to vaccinate or ensure that workers are vaccinated?
Yeah, thanks, Nikolai. All Victorian employers have a duty under the Occupational Health and Safety Act to provide and maintain a working environment that's safe and without risk to health of its employees. And employers looking at having their workers who are working in these environments vaccinated is certainly part of that.
So they do have to do it?
They do, yes.
Yeah, OK. Is abattoirs the big risk area, or do livestock sale yards factor in as well?
Yeah, there's quite a few, and I think Leonard mentioned before, there's quite a few industries right through the supply chain that can be at risk. So abattoirs is certainly one of them. But then we look at industries such as farm and dairies, stockyards, even livestock transporters, and in some instances vets as well, who are treating infected animals.
Now, as we heard from Leonard Valance a few moments ago, he says that the vaccine's quite expensive. Do you think the vaccine being expensive puts people off from undertaking that treatment?
I wasn't aware of the cost of the vaccine, Nikolai, to be honest, but as far as what an employer's obligations are, they're really clear. So the cost aspect of it wouldn't be something that we would look at as being prohibitive from an employer's perspective, no.
And so what happens from here? When are people likely to start to see this awareness campaign being rolled out?
Okay, so as far as the enforceable undertaking is concerned, it needs to be completed within 18 months. So there is 18 months of time for those campaigns to be rolled out.
Adam Watson, thanks for your time on the Country Hour today.
It's a pleasure, Nikolai. Thanks for having me.
Adam Watson, he's Head of Operations and Emergency Management with WorkSafe. On the Country Hour, it is 18 minutes to one. I'm Nikolai Beilharts. Well, let's stick with livestock. Meat and Livestock Australia's sheep industry projections have forecast the Australian lamb and sheep market is set to benefit from reduced supplies and positive demand from domestic consumers in 2017. The latest projections also point to a reduction in Australian lamb slaughter and decreases in both production and exports on the back of a smaller ewe flock and lower lamb markings. MLA's Market Information Manager, Ben Thomas, says lamb slaughter is projected to be 22 million head for 2017.
So 2017 is the first time for a number of years where we're actually expecting Australian sheep meat production to be lower than what it was the year before. And there's a few reasons behind that. Firstly, and one of the main reasons is there was lower lamb marking rates in the second half of 2016, simply due to the ewe flock being a little bit smaller, and just because of the widespread wet conditions, extremely wet conditions that we had in some of our largest lamb producing regions. So you know, with lower numbers and lower production, that does expect to come through the system in 2017. That does, you know, bode pretty well for the market itself, especially if we have a look at what the last 3 or 4 years have done, where on average across the eastern states, our lamb prices have continued to go higher each year, at the same time as production also going higher each of those years. So with a step back or a bit of a decline in production, it should be of a pretty good assistance for the market.
So with a 2% reduction in production, what will that mean for prices next year?
Well, so yeah, like I said, with production expected to be lower this year, it's the first time in about 4 years where we've actually forecast that to be the case. And considering the market was able to sustain the rising production from 2010, basically, right through to where we are now. It really does bode well for producers. Now, the reason the market has been able to, on average across the eastern states, edge higher over each of those years while we've been producing more is because when we have a look over the ditch and see the volumes produced by our Kiwi competitors, their production has slowly been declining as they've concentrated more and more on dairy production. And the reason the Kiwis are important to look at is because between Australia and New Zealand combined, we account for 70% of the global sheep meat trades. And interestingly enough, their most recent reports show that the lamb crop for this year is the lowest it's been since 1953. So it's likely that Kiwi production is going to remain subdued for the foreseeable future.
With prices this year quite close to the highs that were set in 2011, $14.51 a kilo, are we expecting better prices in 2017?
When it does go back to the retail level, and when we have a look at the Australian consumers and ignoring the international demand for a moment, we've seen some really positive signs from our domestic market. So basically, on average this year, the retail price of lamb was $14.51 a kilo. The previous record high was about 10 cents above that back in 2011. Now, what the exciting bit is our consumers are eating a little bit more now than what they were back in 2011. So basically, we're eating more at the same price level. So that's encouraging signs from the strength on how strong the domestic market is.
What about the export market? What is that looking like next year?
So Australia exports, well, it will export next year about 50 to 55% of the lamb that we do produce. That is back slightly from what we did, or will do by the time 2016 is over and have done for the last couple of years. And that's really not because of there being a significant weakening of any of our major international markets. It's more so because of the relative strength of the domestic market and more of it being consumed here with a little bit of population growth. But by and large, our three largest regions, the Middle East, China, and also America, all have their own, unique attributes. And when we have a look at China, for example, they did have quite high production throughout 2016, but in the lead up to what is going to be a very early Lunar New Year for them in 2017, there are indications of the demand to pick up in the first part of the year.
That's MLA's Market Information Manager Ben Thomas speaking there with Courtney Fowler. Sticking with lambs, as we heard earlier, the lamb industry says it's found a new way to try and spruce up some of the secondary cuts that meat buyers tend to overlook. In an Australian first, hot lamb meals are now being dispensed from a cashless vending machine in southern New South Wales. Larissa Smith dropped by the shop where it's operating to find out more.
It's the lunchtime rush at the Sutton Street convenience store here in Cootamundra. And owners Peter and Julie Nolan are flat out looking after locals.
Thank you. Have a lovely afternoon.
Even when the store shuts for the night, their hungry customers are still being fed. But just outside.
Right, so the hot meal has come out of the machine. It's quite warm. And then mix the ingredients up. We've got the tagine sauce and couscous lamb meatballs. And now we just allow the meal to sit for 30 seconds or a minute just to equalise the temperature throughout the meal, and it's ready to go.
Victorian Meat Processors, the Frew Group, Meat and Livestock Australia and the Australian Meat Processors Corporation are behind the vending machine concept. Their goal is to find new ways to value add secondary cuts, which can be overlooked by international meat buyers.
So the MLA recognised through this project that the carcass balance was an issue. Being able to move the trim, that was a problem through the exporters. Trim is always a slow-moving line or a product, so you end up with stores and stores of lamb trim trying to sell at discounted rates to try and move that stuff. If this is another way of being able to move that successfully and making and adding value to the sheep farmer, well then I think it's a win-win for everyone right the way through the supply chain. So the machine looks for the meal that is requested. The conveyor comes up to that level. Then another conveyor pushes the meal onto the delivery conveyor. The conveyor will then go down into the delivery spot of the microwave, and then the 3 kilowatt microwave goes to work for about a minute and a half, and then the meal is dropped down and dispensed. Simple as that.
The project aims to achieve 160 vending machines worldwide within 5 years, targeting markets such as the Netherlands, the US and Japan.
A couple of magazines down, we've got lamb, peppercorn, tamarind meatballs. And then the last one, we've got the Italian lamb meatballs with the pasta.
Now, if these vending machines can sell roughly 10 meals a day, they could bring in around $1.6 million a year in net profit. Store owner Peter Nolan hopes the novel idea will also take off here in Australia.
If we can get that machine to a good, strong performance level, then I can't see why we can't go nationwide with this type of meal and other meals within these machines. We may be able to export that technology. And
ultimately, for you as a farmer, you'd eventually like to see your own lamb in that vending machine.
There's the concept of paddock to plate, but I don't think anywhere in the world where there's a concept of paddock to vending machine. So that's pretty exciting. You wouldn't know where that would go in the end, but yeah, I think just concentrating on the basics and getting the vending machine happening successfully is our main goal now, and you wouldn't know what would happen in the future.
That's New South Wales convenience store owner Peter Nolan talking about his hot lamb meal vending machine with Larissa Smith. Well, fake fur overcoats made of Australian wool are in pretty hot demand in China as their winter season sets in. Independent wool consultant Andrew Dennis says up to 10 million kilos of wool have gone into manufacturing the material, most of which is coming from Australian producers. Mr. Andrew says the material initially saw sluggish demand when it was mass-produced 6 months ago, but during the last month, demand has increased considerably.
It looks like a sheepskin, except it doesn't actually have the skin on the reverse side of it. It's got a knitted fabric where the wool is knitted into this fabric, and it becomes a sheepskin-like material, but they're calling it a fur-like material because they can dye it different colours and make it resemble a fur. Using different processing techniques.
And the reason why they're calling it fake fur as opposed to sheepskin, is that for marketing reasons?
I would imagine it's probably just a marketing thing that fur, translates better into Chinese, or they do actually sell it as a fake fur type material, which is obviously acceptable, rather than wearing a sheepskin. So, sheepskins are aligned with Ugg boots, which are fantastically popular in China, but something like a fur is more of an overcoat material.
So skins for the feet, but furs for the upper body?
Yeah, probably. And
And what are they making out of the material? You've alluded to jackets.
Yeah, so it's principally an overcoat. So often it's a long overcoat, three-quarter length overcoat that is lined either one side or both sides with a sheepskin-like material, but called, in this case, fake fur, which is 100% wool. So it actually consumes a lot of wool because it's quite a heavy product. It's up to a kilo and a half of wool per metre goes into this product. So it actually chews up a lot of wool, which is great in terms of the volume of demand it provides.
And is that reflective in the price? Do you know how much one of these fake fur coats is going for in China at the moment?
I'm not sure of the retail price, to be honest, but it's got a lot of wool in it. If you've got 3 metres of fabric to make an overcoat, you're looking at 4.5 kilos of wool, so there's a reasonable amount in there.
And when did they start manufacturing this material, and how much of it has already been made in China?
Really, it was only developed this year. So in the last 6 months, they've been doing it, and they certainly the last 3 or 4 months, it's really taken off in terms of manufacturing a lot of the fabric, and now they're just starting to sell it. There was some talk that 10,000 tons of wool had been made into this fabric, which is basically 10 million kilos. Whether that's through or beat up a bit, but it's a lot of wool went into this product. A lot of the fabric was made. Then they held their breath collectively, hoping that someone was going to start buying it and using a lot of it. And since the weather has turned cold in China, there has been quite a bit of demand for overcoats and things like that. So it is starting to move through the textile pipeline now.
How much would you say is riding on these Chinese textile manufacturers who have mass-produced this material?
Well, depending on what other products they've done, if they put all their eggs into one basket, well, they've gambled on the success of this fabric. Others, it might just be a sideline for them while they produce other things. But it's certainly it's been the subject of much discussion.
And the material is made from 19.5 micron, which already has very strong market demand. How do you think this places Australian wool producers?
In quite a good position at the moment, given that there is good demand for Australian wool. Certainly at current prices, things are looking quite good.
That's independent wool consultant Andrew Dennis speaking there with Cassandra Steith. Well, Australia's top vet says the country's agricultural sector has a chance to become a world leader in the fight against antimicrobial disease resistance. Globally, there's increasing attention and concern being paid to the spread of superbugs and drug-resistant diseases. Clint Jasper has more.
The World Health Organisation last year implemented a requirement or an expectation that every country would have a national strategy for antimicrobial resistance, and Australia launched its strategy in June last year, and it's jointly developed between health and agriculture, and it's meant to address the whole of the continuum in relation to antimicrobial resistance. In terms of a strategy for agriculture, we've been particularly looking at the issue of the data deficit and the need to collect additional data through surveillance. So last year we undertook a pilot study in the pig industry. This year we're underway with a study with the chicken industry, and next year we'll be looking to undertake work with the salmon industry. So they're three intensive industries.
And how important is knowing the exact contribution of agriculture versus the health system in terms of moving forward with how we tackle antimicrobial resistance?
Knowing that we use antibiotics in livestock, and those livestock eventually become food products, what is the contribution of those food products to the issue of antimicrobial resistance that we're seeing in the human population? Our current understanding is that contribution is relatively small, that most of the antibiotic resistance that we see in the human population is through inappropriate use of antibiotics by humans when they go to the GP or in hospital exposure or exposure to resistant bacteria in the community.
Given that Australian animals are produced on more open and grass-fed systems, what would be your anticipation of Australia's food contribution to the global problem?
As you say, we're very fortunate in Australia that Australian livestock is largely grown on a grass-fed basis, particularly our sheep and cattle industry. And Australian exports a lot of beef and sheep meat, but the contribution to the global trade is quite small, so we're only a small contributor to the global trade in meat products. I believe that there's a real opportunity here for Australian agriculture, that we have a nimble systems. We've got traceability back to the farm level. We have very good certification and attestation systems, vendor declarations. I think there's an opportunity here for Australia to pitch itself at the top of the market to meet those market demands for antibiotic-free meat, or to have low contributions of antibiotic use to production of meat and meat products. And I think that's the opportunity for Australian agriculture into the future.
Clint Jasper with that report. Just the one market being a Friday, it is Shepparton with Jenny Kelly.
Good afternoon. Lamb numbers eased to 2,000, while a few more sheep come forward for a total yarding of around 3,000 head. The lineup of young lambs presented in a bit fresher condition than a week ago, and with the return of a major export buyer who was absent last week, the market did show more consistency and was a few dollars dearer at the top end. The market reached a top of $142 for heavy export suckers, although sales over 130 were limited to just 10 pens across the yarding. The general run of domestic kill lambs, 22 kilos and less, mostly made from $109 to $120. On a carcass basis, most of these slaughter lambs are working out at between 480 to 520 cents a kilo. Small unshorn lambs, mostly made from 86 to 106, with odd pens going to the paddock, but there wasn't many lines on offer to suit restockers. Bidding for a mixed selection of shorn lambs was erratic at times, partly due to quality and some mixed lots. The best medium trade weight shorn lamb sold to $122, and local agents paid from $109 to $118 for some to go back to the paddock. The sheep sale comprised about 1,000 head. Heavy crossbred ewes did show an easier trend, making from $90 to $117. A fair percentage of heavy Dorper ewes in the yarding made from $90 to $112. The Merino selection was very limited, with the best ewes to $106. Jenny Kelly, MLA.
Thanks so much, Jenny. That is the Country Hour for today and the week. Anything more you need to know, including all those details of the S. Kidman & Co. sale, up on the website, abc.net.au/rural. Time for the news now on ABC Victoria. It's 1 o'clock.